Blog Talk Radio.
Last night I went to my second Starbucks, and I went there to do some writing, some blogging, wanted to get some reading done, and also then I would have prepared for the show, you know, kind of figure out exactly what I'm going to cover, what blogs I wanted to come out and read, and so forth. And then it all came to me because I got absolutely none of that done. I see that I already have some calls on the board. I'm going to come to you guys after I read the blog post. Please keep on listening in. Like I said, I went to do some reading, blogging, and I wanted to get a paper written. And as it turns out, there was a young man that was there. And it was interesting because a friend of mine that's always there all the time, this is a staunch Republican guy, real conservative guy. We always drink coffee and kind of shoot the bull together. He started talking to me about genealogy and some other things that he was going through. And then he said, "Hey, Egberto, you know what? I read your book, man, and it was pretty good. I agree with most of it, but you know the parts that I don't agree with because, you know, he's a super conservative guy. There's a young guy. This guy was in his late 20s, probably early 30s. And while I continued, after my friend left and I continued reading and writing, he said, "You wrote a book." So I'm like, "Oh, yeah, you know, one on, you know, it's a pretty liberal book on what I think about the government, the difference between the, or rather, how we should compartmentalize the individual, the government, and the corporation, that sort of thing." And the conversation went on for 3 hours. And this young man was a staunch Republican as well. I don't think he left after we spoke. I don't think he left a staunch Republican any longer, but the conversation was great because he had a whole lot to say. And it was amazing. The situation that he was in at this point in time was that he had a minimum wage job. He was still trying to make it. He has a whole lot of college. He never got his degree, but he had a lot of college hours. But all he had right now was a minimum wage job. And we went into some different issues as far as what the government should do. And you know that the typical mantra on the right is that, you know, we're individuals and we should all stand on our own and all that sort of thing. And we went through some issues that his own beliefs and his own policies could be some of those same things that prevent him from moving ahead while he beats himself up as opposed to a society that can help move him forward. So that kind of gave rise to what I decided to talk about. What do you want out of your government? Today at our Move to Amend monthly meeting, Dr. Theis was out there and we're talking, and I asked him to be on the show, and he said, yes, he'll talk, because as you know, if there's one person who knows everything about government and what needs to be done to move this society forward, is Dr. Theis. So after I read my blog, my typical reading, I'm going to bring the doctor in. But we had a little talk today about Governor Christie, Rand Paul, and whether he could win and so forth. And I think we had a little disagreement on that I want him to cover on the Daily Coast page where I am I'm actually writing this piece. So anyway, this is a piece that's going to be going up on Daily Coast on Sunday. Please, guys, read it and make some comments on the post. And when I'm done with this, we're going to bring the doctor in. The title of my post was Governor Chris Christie, Senator Rand Paul feud could make Christie president. And here it goes. Rand Paul surrendered. He ran the risk of opening an inter-party debate that needs to be had. Chris Christie, a real conservative that is willing to go off the ideological track, is not to be messed with. He is willing to call out those that are much more intellectually dishonest than he is. Rand Paul and the pseudo-conservative libertarians could not allow the debate to go there. Rand Paul did what he had to do. He surrendered and asked Chris Christie to a beer summit. So how did this Republican feud get started? A few days ago, Christie said that there was a strain of libertarianism on both the left and the right that opposes the NSA surveillance program. He then used the standard 9/11 defense of the program. Rand Paul responded by implying that was a cheap shot and accused Christie of having the gimme-gimme disease, always wanting from the government. Christie responded that New Jersey gives much more to the U.S. Treasury than it gets back, and by contrast, Kentucky gets back much more than they put in. Rand Paul attempted to imply that their two military bases were the reasons, not realizing that New Jersey has 8 military bases. Continuing the discussion for Rand Paul was pointless. He was beaten. It turns out that Kentucky, Rand Paul's state, is in fact the gimme, gimme, gimme state, the welfare state. Chris Christie cracked that door open. The chart below is quite illuminating. Texas is the only red state that gets back less than it sends to Washington, of course. Texas's wealth of natural resources can hide a lot of its intrinsic dysfunction. The above chart, same chart, and many others have been circulating over the internet for years. They are modified as new data becomes available. One would think that every time a red state politician started grandstanding about smaller government, the mainstream media would ask them if they realized their stance was disproportionately harming their states. In fact, the chart demonstrates a particular pathology that is systemic mostly with red states. One must wonder why the mainstream media's objective journalists do not feel compelled to investigate this reality with in-depth reporting and specials. Rand Paul inadvertently opened that door for debate. Most importantly, since the argument was made by a Republican to a Republican, it runs the risk of being heard by Republicans. Had these facts been made or articulated by Democrats or liberals, no one on the right would be listening to them or be receptive of learning the fact that Kentucky, as well as all but one red state, are very dependent on the federal government. Conventional wisdom by most in the mainstream media and other talking heads is that Chris Christie cannot make it out of a Republican primary because he is not conservative enough. Some believe his acceptance of the Obamacare Medicaid expansion was one of the nails in his presidential coffin. Christie has already earned his conservative bona fides. He canceled a much-needed tunnel project. He lambasted unions, even as some unions endorsed him, likely for political reasons. He revived a tax cut proposal that gives most of the benefits to the top 1%. He attacked the Supreme Court decision for ruling that key parts of DOMA were unconstitutional, and on and on and on. If Christie decides to run for president, he will win the Republican primary. He is a conservative and made the minimal political moves in a blue state to remain so. He is willing to defend his policies even if he has to destroy the false narratives of his red state's rivals. He will make them the fake conservatives for preaching small government even as they are on the dole. He will spin his acceptance of Obamacare Medicaid expansion as a fiscally responsible move on a bill that has conservative origins. Christie will use the social welfare red state reality and make any additional austerity proposals by the right-wingers an attack on the red state's middle class. He will make himself the only adult in the room. Republicans want to win the White House. They have lost the popular vote in five of the last six elections. 2016 is likely the last election that they can win without revamping their party. While the far right claims that the party is not sufficiently to the right, most Republicans know better. If they were willing to elect Mitt Romney, the governor that actually passed Massachusetts' version of Obamacare, they surely would be willing to elect Christie, who uses it to the benefit of his indigent and make money for insurance companies, hospitals, and drug makers. Ultimately, the real question is, can Christie beat Hillary Clinton? As a blue state conservative Republican who uses his brashness when questioned to deflect from the actual policies, as a mainstream media darling, and as a recipient of poor mainstream media scrutiny and in-depth analysis, the answer is yes. If Hillary Clinton is tied to Bill Clinton and a narrative constructed with his Glass-Steagall sin, the answer is yes. If, however, the country buys into two tenets, Hillary will win. If the country believes the truth that governance by testosterone has been a failure to the middle class and that conservative policies by Republicans and Democrats alike decimated the middle class, then Hillary Clinton can win. The exuberance of many that assume that because of demographic changes, a Republican cannot win the presidency is false. A Republican like Governor Chris Christie can. And the doors are open to my good friend, Dr. Dice. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you, Egberto?
I know you take exception to what I just said, so before we even go into what should we want from government, my dear friend, make your point, and please send everybody that. That'll be on the front page tomorrow. Please take a look at it and make your comments as well. But Dr. Tice, I really want you to make your comment on that particular
Well, let me first of all just say that you were far too generous when you said I know everything about government. I would never make that claim. I think.
Well, it wasn't you, Doc. It wasn't you who made the claim. I was the one who made the claim, and I stand by my claim, sir.
Well, I wouldn't. Who knows? And you may prove me wrong in 2016. I just think the way the Republican Party breaks down the demographics, the ideological patterns of their voters, and I think it's really important to remember who the primary voters are, not general election voters, because those are two totally different populations.
Right.
But it's going to be very hard for somebody like Chris Christie to win the Republican nomination. Not impossible, but extremely difficult. And I think sometimes those of us that are sort of wonky policy people that follow politics on a regular basis put a lot more faith into the rationality of voters than is actually deserved. And I think that among rank-and-file Republican primary voters, and I know I'm going to make a lot of them really mad, the picture of Chris Christie with Barack Obama in the aftermath of Sandy will be on every other candidate's commercials. And just that picture is going to strike an emotional chord that's going to be a huge problem for Chris.
Yeah, I see that. I really see that, and I think I took that into account. But my personal opinion in talking to a whole lot of our, and you know where we live, Doc. It's really,
yeah,
you know how conservative our area is, and I find here in Kingwood per se, and folks from around the country, I would love to hear your opinions as well. But I find in Kingwood that the people, the very conservative people, including a lot of my friends at Starbucks, they seem to be very receptive to Christie. So, I mean, I wonder sometimes, and you know our area, our area is a real voting area. So I cannot say that we represent a lot of America, but I wonder.
Well, But our area is also very economically affluent, and that's very different than many of the rank and file. We've got a lot more country club Republicans in our area.
Well, that's true.
I mean, we don't have blue-collar Republicans at all in our area. So I think that's something you have to take into account.
That I think is partially true. Okay, let me add, getting on to the real subject. Did you hear that partial story that I was talking about, the young man that I met in Starbucks at all?
Yeah, and I run into that all the time also.
Now, what my initial question was, and folks, before I forget to give the call numbers, please give us a call, 646-929-2495. Again, the number is 646-929-2495. When you call in, if you want to speak, please push the number 1 so that I can know to call on you. Hey, and I see that Janine is here with us, so later on I'm going to bring you in, Janine, to add to the discussion as well. But yes, Doc, as I was saying, what I wanted, after talking to this young man and realizing that there are a lot of items that we can see, some of the programs that I see the Obama administration has tried to push that it's going to go nowhere, that would have positively give this guy, both in education and otherwise, an opportunity for upward mobility. But still, in his thoughts at the time, before our conversation, he was willing to simply discount any possibility of anything from government and had the standard stereotype of a lot of, I think, his problems were attributed to others. When I say others, I mean the other, if you know what I mean. So what do you think?
Right. Well, I think that's true. I was at a Tea Party meeting not too long ago, and you look around that room and realize that virtually every single person in that room was getting government assistance.
Right.
And yet they were railing on how the government doesn't do anything well, we want to cut the budget. But they didn't want to see Social Security cut. They didn't want to see Medicare cut, because those were programs that they were benefiting from. They wanted
right.
to see welfare cut. And I have this same discussion with my students, you know, hot topic right now is drug testing welfare. I do some exercises with my classes. And that's always something that they think would be a really good idea, because people shouldn't be doing drugs and getting welfare. And I can see that completely, and then I ask a simple question, well, what is welfare? You guys are all here with Pell Grants. That's welfare. So should you guys get drug tested? Well, they don't mean Pell Grants. That's not welfare. But in fact, it is. And that's why I said earlier that racial issue. I mean, we have a big race problem in this country, and you know it, Egberto.
Yes, sir.
We don't confront it. We pretend it doesn't exist. The right talks about no special treatment based on category. But we've had a 300-year history as a country where people have been treated special based on their racial category. It happened to be, if you were white, you got special treatment. And that just doesn't go away overnight. I don't think you can say the laws are gone, so everything's okay. And that has, you're familiar with Lee Atwater's quote. I mean, the Republican
yes.
strategy for the last 30 years has been to play on that. And
you know what, Doc, before
we
you
see
go
it
in further,
all
what?
The time.
Doc, before you go any further, kind of explain that Lee Atwater statement, because it was it partially was, we don't have to use that N-word anymore. Kind of explain that to people.
Well, yeah, he had a quote. It was in a book, Southern Politics, or Politics of the South. I forget the exact title. And he said that in the 1950s, he used the N-word to stir up racial animosities and to get white voters to vote a certain way. Of course, at that time, it was the Democrats doing that.
Right.
But by the 1960s, you sort of became more abstract. You talked about things like busing states' rights. By the 1980s, you became even more abstract, talking about welfare, talking about taxes, things that were necessarily going to hurt African American and Latino people worse than whites. And people understood it. And he, in fact, says the effect was to hurt minority groups, but you don't use the same language.
You know, it's interesting because I never had to mention that with the young man that I was speaking to yesterday. And one of the great things that happened with that discussion, Doc, is that this young man, after we got into the conversation and it was no longer a polarized conversation, in other words, he no longer felt that I was there to bash the right, and I never gave him the impression that I thought he was there to bash the left or anything. We suddenly started talking, and the conversation was so smooth, and that's why it lasted over 3 hours, that he was able to tell me, he looked at me and he said, he couldn't say my name, well, you know, I have that strange name, but he said, Egberto, I'm going to tell you some things that hits me. And he told me, you know, I am a white guy, and yes, I do feel some animosity against African Americans, and of course, you know me, please call it black folks, okay? Then he said, okay, and then he said, the animosity that I have is that, you know, let me tell you a story. Me and my brother went to play at some school in Miami, and he was one of the only white guys on the team, and they started shouting the whole thing, cracker, 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 that sort of a thing on the courts. And then he said, Egberto, that never made the news. Think about it, if it were the opposite way around, would that have made the news? And then I said, yes, it would have. Then he said, oh, thank you for accepting that the news is biased. Then I said, but wait a minute, you're correct. But don't think because I'm agreeing that the news is biased that there aren't other things. So then we started getting into certain things like privilege and all that sort of thing. And I wish I could have really taped and videoed the type of conversation that we had, because it was really good to see this guy open up and see, you know, his prejudices, the prejudice against him and how it affected his life and how his current socioeconomic conditions have him with some animosities against Latinos and blacks. And he opened up on all those particular issues. And by the end of the night, you know, he looked and he, you know, one of the things that I looked at him and I said, don't run the risk. Just like I am not going to judge everybody that looks like you because of what somebody else says or what their behavior is. If we stopped for 1 minute and started looking at policies instead of these silly issues, we would be that much further apart. Then I gave him the story about the divide and conquer, that a lot of these issues come from the top. The way the news media does things is to make people like you have that feeling of you're not getting a fair shake. And how can you not get a fair shake? They make it seem like you're not getting a fair shake. And then they create this sort of a friction between people. And then the powers that be, the plutocracy, remains.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. What happens in our society is race being a primary sort of frame of reference for people totally clouds the real class differences that exist
right.
in the country, the differences between the rich and the poor. And the fact is, white, black, Latino, we're by and large all in the same boat.
Right.
There's the top 1-2% that has most of the wealth of this country, that own this country, and the other 98-99% of us are basically working to try and make ends meet. If we're smart and we save, we might have a nice house and a nice car and a little bit of money in savings. But the reality is very few of us are going to make it into the super rich.
Right.
And in fact, I mean, two great examples. People talk about Bill Gates as sort of, see, if you come up with a great idea, you can be rich too. And they use Bill Gates as an example. Well, Bill Gates' dad was, if you Wikipedia him, his dad, they say he's a prominent philanthropist, a person that
right.
gave away money. So Bill Gates came from a very wealthy family, had huge advantages, People know that story. Donald Trump's another one. He is not a self-made man. He inherited $400 million from his dad. So if you begin to get behind some of the rhetoric out there, the odds of anybody actually being rich, which is what is held out in our society as the ultimate success, are slim to none. In fact, European countries have higher levels of social mobility between classes than we do.
Explain what that is, Professor. A lot of people don't quite understand what the upward mobility means.
Well, social mobility is the ability, well, if you take a person that's born in the poorest 20%, what are the odds that they will make it to the richest 20%? Or somebody born in the richest 20%, what's the odds that they will be in the poorest 20% over the course of their lifetime? And what we find is there's not much change in the United States. If you're born in the poorest 20%, you're likely to stay in the poorest 20%. That's not everybody.
Yeah,
but
that is.
You're more likely than not to be there. Whereas, and those numbers for us, we're actually, if you're born in the lowest 20%, you're more likely to stay in the lowest 20% your whole life than if you were born in, say, England or France or European countries, or even, for that matter, South Korea or Japan, which I'm a little more familiar with.
Right.
So now, the ability to move between economic classes is pretty low in this country. It's not the mythology. The mythology is that we have a very upwardly mobile society.
Absolutely. So now, it is interesting that that this guy didn't quite realize that then, but I think at the end of the discussion, he actually, you could actually see his mind going and thinking, and that is the kind of stuff that gives me hope. A lot of people, it was funny because today on my page, a guy put, I don't know if you saw the video that I did with two conservative ladies discussing Obamacare and that sort of thing, but I was positive with these ladies, and I asked them things like, well, if I were to show you objective information, are you willing to take a look at it and that sort of thing? And they said yes, and this guy wrote me an email, and he says, how the hell do you stay so positive among these folks? And I'm like, well, what is getting mad going to do? And that's what you and I do when we go out there and do our move to amend things and try to engage the people in a place as conservative as we are, and so and so forth. But I want to ask you something, Doc, and it goes this way, because I got a bit upset at something the president said. And he's running around the country right now giving a whole lot of speeches on employment and moving the economy forward and so forth. And he had a whole lot of good words to say, but there's something that really struck me immediately and got me actually quite upset. And he made the statement that follows, and I'd like you to expand on this, why a lot of people are talking like this. He said, we want, and I'm paraphrasing here, we want to go ahead and provide all these work programs, et cetera, because we accept the fact that in order for a country to be vibrant and innovative, that you must have some sort of income disparity as we have today. That's paraphrasing. That's not exactly what he said, but that's exactly what he implied.
So he was saying it's okay, it's good to have wide disparities of income?
He's saying it's good to, he said that we have made the trade-off to have wide disparity of incomes, but in the process we must have the support system for the average American citizen, meaning we must have the support for the middle class. But in effect, he came into acceptance that wide disparity is okay, as long as there's a middle class.
As long as there's a middle class. Well, the problem is the middle class is disappearing. It's shrinking. And we know that from a number of different studies that are out there. Great Divergence, Timothy Noah's book, is very good on that issue. I don't know quite what to make of it, given that this guy's the president, and he represents the Democratic Party, which is supposed to be the party of the working class. I think it's a statement on how far to the right our country has gone that we would accept what our third world levels of income inequality.
That is my biggest concern here. And what I wanted to kind of, first of all, wanted to dispel that myth that you need wide income and wealth disparity for there to be innovation in a country. I think we can show countries with much less disparities that are very innovative. And in fact, we are no longer the top country. I don't have the link on a post that I made a while back that showed we are no longer the most innovative country. So, I mean, it seems like these types of theories are thrown out there. You know, our plutocracy put them out there, and our politicians just accept them as fact, as opposed to, you know, simply doing some numerical analysis. How can people gouge in capital be innovative? Please tell me.
Well, it's not innovative. What's happening in our economy, and the reason people, if you look at the people that are making a lot of money, they're not people that are innovating. They're people that are engaging in rent-seeking behavior. Rent-seeking behavior is behavior that takes a percentage, a cut off the top. So the mafia are not innovative. The mafia are rent seekers. They take a cut off all the businesses that are operating. It's the same thing in our economy today. Banks are not innovators. They're rent seekers. Landlords are not innovators. They're rent seekers. Okay? When wages are cut in order to boost corporate profits, that's rent seeking. It's not rent seeking if they created a bunch of new innovative products. And so
Right. Our
economy today is based primarily on rent-seeking behaviors. And Emmanuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, who does a lot of work on the incomes of the top 1% and everybody else and the income distribution historically, did a great little interview, which I'll send it to you and you can post it.
Okay.
Talking about that. And I think I don't have a problem with people making money. I think everybody should make money. But I think you should make money for contributing in a positive way.
Exactly.
For working, for inventing things, for creating products. That's not how how people get rich in our society. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein didn't create a thing.
Right. None of these guys create anything. All they do is move capital. And, you know, that is one of the things that I think is the most upsetting. When I wrote the piece, What is Your Worth? In other words, we need to work on our worth. Why do we have to start teaching ourselves that not to be all that deferential and respectful to the broker and the banker as if they have done much for society. I'm much more deferential to the teacher, the professor, the engineer, the doctor. These are people that are actually contributing to society. These are the guys. Why, first of all, do they command the highest amount of pay, wages, and the others don't? I think it's a mindset that until we start. And I hate to sound like a psychologist because I'm not trained as one. I'm an engineer. But I hate to sound like a psychologist, but we have to start working on people's minds to not have them believe that somehow there is some difference that these folks have actually earned. They've earned nothing. Folks, remember, the telephone number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. I see many of you on, but don't have your hands up yet. Janine, I'm going to be coming to you in a little bit to get some input from you for both myself and Dr. Theis. Also, I'd like folks to be thinking, what do you want out of your government? What do you want out of your government? Janine, just before I come to you, there's a somebody that came up in the queue. So let me get 111 here. I think it's probably a Skype call. Who do I have the honor of speaking to right now?
You have the honor of speaking to me.
I have the honor of speaking to you. And who are you, my dear friend?
The man who's talking to you.
You're not going to give me a first name?
Yeah, my name's Joe. I've called before.
What's your name?
Joe.
Hey, Joe, what's up, my brother?
Hey, how you doing?
Talk to me.
Well, let me get to your last point about
yes.
people who aren't, people who just make money, maybe they're not earning or they're contributing to society. Anybody who makes a living wage or any kind of wage, regardless of whether people think it's too much or too little, they are doing something for their employer. Therefore, they have some sort of intrinsic worth. Otherwise, they wouldn't be being paid for it. Now, to answer the next to last question, rather, that was the next to last. Now, to answer your last question, what do I want out of government? To stay the hell away from me.
Okay, tell me more.
I don't want government in my life at all, except for national defense, maybe to oversee the judicial system. And outside of that, I'll just leave it up to me and everybody else who is innovative to use mm-hmm. our creativity and our imagination to create commerce and business. By doing that, that's how a society grows. So I want government out of my life.
Okay, I would love to entertain a discourse right now between you and Dr. Theis. Dr. Theis, why don't you make a comment on the government staying the hell out of my good friend Joe's life?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's countries where the government stays the hell out and doesn't do anything, and they're not especially good places to live.
What countries are those?
What?
Which countries are those?
Well, look at Somalia. Look at Afghanistan.
Oh, please.
All throughout Africa, they're typically called third world countries.
Africa is being populated by China the way that we populated the Middle East. And Afghanistan, they don't have natural resources because we took it.
Actually, they have a bunch of natural resources.
I said we took it. They have $1 trillion worth of lithium and other mineral rights in their country, but we have it. So they can't do what they want. Saudi Arabia was guilty of the same thing until they found oil. Then when they got money coming in, they developed their country. So the idea that, you know, if you leave people alone, they're not going to do anything. It depends upon the natural resources and government.
No,
if they're not developing, that's because government
is failing. I mean, you misunderstand my point.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they're not going to do anything. It's just not a very good place for most people to live.
So? if not a lot of people are going to be living there, there's not going to be that much of a population. But if they develop their resources through manufacturing, they have the means in order to create an economy. If people are out of their lives, Russia's not out of wasn't out of their lives. We're not out of their lives. So I don't think Afghanistan is really a good example.
Well, I said Somalia too, and there's others. But think about, I mean, why do you think government does the things it does today?
In order to control people.
Why does government regulate businesses?
If government was truly for people, they would let people do what they want to do as long as they don't bother other people. All governments in mind have the agenda of controlling their citizens.
So let me jump into the discussion here for a second, Joe, and let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you don't consider we the people the government? Is that correct?
If it's governed by those who consent to it, yeah. But right now we have a phony government. We elect people to represent us, but they don't represent us. And
why do you think that's the case?
Because of corruption.
And what kind of corruption is that specifically?
The kind of corruption in which the congressmen become millionaires by just following the control of the lobbyists.
And who controls the lobbyists?
Who controls the lobbyists?
Yes.
Corporations.
Right. That's where I was trying to get you. So,
well,
I mean, you're saying, let me just say one thing, Doc. I think you just made my point. And first of all, you are correct that a corrupt government should have no place in your life. But here's what you've just told me. You've just told me that that corporations controlling the government has made many of the citizens' lives difficult. Now, let's remove the government out of that equation that I just gave, and you've just said corporations mm-hmm. have made the average citizen's life very difficult. Because here's
okay.
the deal. But you've just made
well,
that
I didn't say
statement.
That, but I mean, that's okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to say is what I want personally mm-hmm. is representative government. And by the way, I'm going to have to put a plug for my book right here because you're a candidate for my book. As I see it, class warfare, the only resort to right-wing doom. Because I'm not anti-corporation. I just think you have to have that balance between the individual rights, the corporation, and the government. You should check that out because I think I lay out a pretty a convincing portion. I'm not an intellectual like my buddy here, the Dr. Theis, who knows about the intricacies of government, but I'm a layman mm-hmm. and engineer, and I talk everything through engineer's terms. So you should
okay.
check that you should check that out. And the reason why is I think we have more in common than you would actually think with respect to the government. But if you really looked at it objectively, I have another caller I need to get to. But I'm
okay.
keeping both you and Dr. Theis open on the line because this is a good conversation that I want to continue. 210-210, you're hot. Who do I have the honor of speaking to?
Yeah, this is John from San Antonio.
Hey, John, my buddy in San Antonio, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, first I want to say I really admire what the professor is saying. It seems like I agree with everything that he said so far. I think he's a real bastion of wisdom. One thing I might slightly disagree with, though, is, you know, and this is taken with a grain of salt because... It's 3.5 years, or a little over 3 years before this 2016 election. So, it's a little bit early to talk about this. But one thing concerning your side, Egberto,
mm-hmm.
or your take on the Christie-Paul, talk, is that the Republicans historically... since 1960, has always nominated the person who is next in line. In other words, people who have already ran before or have held high office, starting in Nixon 60, Goldwater in 64 was a prominent senator, Nixon again in 68 and 72, Ford was vice president. Reagan in 80 had ran in 76 and 68 and 84, Bush Sr. 88, Dole in 96. The only exception was W, who was essentially in because of his cronyism. And if he wasn't named Bush, he probably wouldn't have won. McCain in 2008.
That's true.
And one of the main reasons that Romney won the Republican primary with people who were much more conservative than he was is because people thought that he could win. People were looking at polling and they were seeing that he was closer than anybody else
beating Obama.
To Obama, and that's why they nominated him. Overwhelmingly, if you look at polling information, they said the reason why they picked him was because, including states in the South, is because they felt that he had the best chance to win. And so, that's my Christie, argument, that people will realize, they'll start looking at polls, and there's no doubt that more people in the center will be close to the Christie. There's a lot of polling already out saying Christie is much closer to Hillary Clinton, and it's become much closer. I talked about this 3 weeks ago. But on the other side, in fact, why Christie ignited this whole started this whole thing going is that he is behind now for the past 4 months, almost in every poll, 6 out of 7 national polls, Rubio was ahead. And
right.
when the far right decided, that we're not going to go along with this. We're not going to go along with this rebranding. We're going to go into our nativism. And right, and go into that. All of a sudden, there was a change. And for a couple of polls, Christie was ahead. And then Rand Paul in a PP poll was ahead. And in five different states, Rand Paul was ahead. Montana, Iowa, Michigan, Wyoming, and Alaska. And a lot of it could also come down to, how many of the let's say, if Cruz and Rand Paul run both of them, mm-hmm. they may cancel out each other's vote. And the same thing could happen with Bush and Christie.
Rubio.
So I mean, I think that those are going to be the major points of contention. And what I want to see is I want to see polling on how Elizabeth Warren would do against the other, against Christie and against Paul and against these people, because the polling with Biden against those top-notch Republican people are pretty bad. I mean, they're pretty bad against Biden.
John, let me ask you something. And 404, I see that you're waiting to come on, so I'm going to come to you after John. What do you think? Do you think Elizabeth Warren has enough name recognition around the country yet for us to be able to do any kind of good national polling?
Yeah, I mean, they've already done a ton of. There's been about I'd say seven different national polls, and she's consistently been, third.
Okay.
The problem is that she's at about 6%, where Hillary is at 60, and Biden's about 12 on average, So the premise is, I mean, I'm a huge Elizabeth Warren fan, and so I mean, nothing would make me happier in politics to see her nominated and to win. But,
no, let me tell you
one thing
about that, John. Let me just say one thing. I like Elizabeth Warren as well. I am concerned that something many people speak about as far as how influential the corporations are again, in that she had a vote that she was supposed to make on, I think, GMOs, and I think that was the one vote that had many of us concerned about her supporting the drug companies. I mean, the drug companies then. But anyway, continue.
I mean, I'm not saying she's perfect. I don't agree with everything that she does. But, I mean, a majority of it I do agree with, and I think that it would be great. I don't know if the country is ready for. I mean, the country definitely wasn't ready for Nader, and so I mean that this is a big question in people's mind. Do you waste your vote on somebody who you really truly want to win? Or do you support somebody who's going to have small incremental change? I mean, like on Daily Kos, there was a diary right at the top of the rec list when I woke up, dealing with how Hillary Clinton was on the board of directors of Walmart, and how her corporate ties are, and then, if you look at her record, it's not a progressive record. But
was that article
said,
today?
Yeah, it's on the recommended list, and
I'm
talks about the Walton family, and people who follow politics closely know about Hillary Clinton. They know all of her her strengths and her weaknesses, and I would definitely vote for her, given the choice between her and any Republican. But I mean, this is some of the dilemmas that people have to face. And and as far as the guy who was talking about he doesn't want government, God, thank God that guy wasn't living during World War II and didn't have that attitude during World War II.
I tell you something about Joe, John, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I needed to say this. I think, a lot of times we listen to just the sound bite of what somebody says, and then we completely react to that sound bite. I don't know if you saw where I was driving, Joe, where I actually said where he eventually said that lobbyists were controlled by corporations. And then I said, okay, you remove the lobbyists and the government, and what you have, the corporation controlling the people, right? So, I mean, I think, and I learned this from several people over the last several years, I guess, and specifically from a young man who was doing some work on campus this week. On a lot of times, it's all about how things are formulated. But stick with me, John. Let me get to 404 because he's been waiting for us. That person's been waiting for a while. 404, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Robert Rodrigo, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Roberto Rodrigo, talk to me, my friend.
Well, I guess.
I lost Robert. I guess he'll call back. He must be on his cell phone. But anyway, continuing with the conversation till we get Robert back. You see what I was talking about, Joe, right? I think he's back. Let me get him back. Okay, something happened, Robert. Talk to me.
Yeah, I hung up on you.
Oh, I'm so – look, you just hurt my feeling, buddy.
I'm not talking to you. Let me hang up. a couple of quick comments about what John was talking about, what you guys are talking about in general, and I want to bring a couple things up. As far as Christy and Paul and Hillary and Elizabeth, et cetera, my first comment is that it seems to me like what we're doing here in this conversation, and mind you, this is just my personal view, of course, is, gentlemen, I would offer to you that it's 2013, and one of our problems in this country is that we have an election cycle that is ridiculously long, and we're helping it right along with this conversation and general mindset, and as we know, our media is talking about it every day, which is why we're talking about it, partially, and of course, we do have our hopes for our, you know, who's going to fit in and all that other stuff, but I would ask to take a deep breath and focus on the issues of today, because I don't even know if we even know what's going to happen. I personally don't believe that a woman's going to be president in my lifetime. Or
really?
I really do. I actually posted something this morning about the recent reactions to the Chuck Hagel investigation of the military and how they are suspending people for the behavior with sexual harassment. I believe the world is more sexist than it is racist. And considering how racist the world is, that'll give you an idea of what level of sexism I think is going on. I believe that Hillary Clinton, from the standpoint of experience and what we should look for presidential qualities, qualified much better for the primary ticket than Barack Obama, regardless of who I voted for or who I like or whatever, even if I
– right.
Because I'm not even going to get into that. And then, of course, you know, to support what John was saying about Elizabeth Warren, she certainly has enough name recognition as it did Barack Obama, with the exception of the fact that he spoke at the previous Democratic convention, which got him a little play. But it is 2013, and the election is 2016, and you know, we have been doing this since the conventions. We've been talking about Rand Paul, we've been talking about Christie, when before the last election happened, how he's going to be on the ticket next time, and I'm like, oh my God, they're killing me. And, of course, I would never want Chris Christie as a president just on the basis of his same-sex marriage issue. He's one of the worst that there is in the country on it, actually. I was watching Ma last night.
Hold one second, Robert. Let me just break in 1 second. Oh, yeah. I think. Let me break in 1 second, Robert, and then I need to bring in the doc again as well. Doc, your mic is going to be hot in a minute. Okay, let me just say one thing, and that is – In defense of how we got to the Christie Rand Paul stuff, the story was a bit deeper. It started with what happened with the states that actually provide. Oops, who's is that? You prevented a whole lot of wind, Robert?
No, not me. It's quiet here.
Okay. Anyway, it started out with the disparity with which states provide to the federal government, big government versus small government. So that's how we actually got into that topic. But anyway, continue, my friend.
Well, it just concerns me that we're spending a lot of time on that. You know, I'll give you an example of why it concerns me. Yeah, 2 days ago, our Senate Select Committee voted on whether or not to send arms to Syria.
Right.
And that classified the vote. Now,
right.
I want to think about it for a second. They classify the vote so we as constituents cannot even hold our individual senators accountable for which way we wanted them to vote.
Okay, wait, stop a second. Are you telling? I didn't even know about that. You're telling me that there was
that.
A vote on Syria arms yesterday?
There was 2 days ago at the Senate Select Committee, and the House is getting ready to do it too. And one of the things that has been going on is they've been asking Senator Feinstein and other people in the House and in the Senate, you know, what's their position on it, and they will not comment on what their feelings on it because they've classified it.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I mean, that's deep stuff we're talking about here. You know,
now, how did you find that out, Robert?
Actually, it was reported by, first of all, I keep track of everything that goes on in Congress.
Right.
Literally everything. It's an amazing, ridiculous amount of time I spent browsing through Senate resolutions on we want to make this day and this year and this thing. It's amazing. So it's been going on through there, but I could never tell what was happening. So there was a vote on it in committee. And so if you look at the Library of Congress website, you'll see that. And then the various alternative news organizations have been reporting about their conversations with the individual committees. And actually, I can see if I can find it real quick. Where
okay, I'm getting an echo. Are you on a speakerphone? I'm getting an echo from somebody.
I am.
Okay, maybe that's
no, not
you.
For me. It's really quiet where I am. I'm sitting in my truck. I'm
okay,
not
I'm going to put the other phones on mute, and then I'm going to come back to you, Doc, because I want to hear your response to some of the stuff that Robert's been saying. Okay, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, so there was – let me see if I can get to my – one thing about this phone is I can't look up stuff when I'm on it. I have to get off it first. But when I finish my comment, I'll get off and come back, and I'll post it. Or I'll get it so I can say exactly where I was reading it this morning. Because I don't post anything unless I vet it. So what
right.
I did was is I saw it and I put it up in my wall only while I got into it a little bit. Well, I've done some research through it because I get all these updates from the Library of Congress on what the House and the Senate are doing. I mean, I literally track everything that goes on. You know, I don't read everything. I do it by title first because there's so much crap that they do that's a waste of my time. But So this just happened a couple of days ago, and the vote is classified, which is amazing.
That's crazy.
It totally is. It's my problem with a lot of what's going on here with our elected officials is, you know, when they decide to disregard the rule of law, meaning the constitutional approach to everything, you know, they don't really get it back from me. You know, I then become – this is where I get to that part where can you name 10 people that in Washington that work for us? So far, the highest number I've gotten is 6, by the way.
Right.
And I just got that yesterday.
Bobby, I want to stop you here a second for one reason.
Mm-hmm.
I want to stop you for one reason. Notice when you came up with this story, I looked at you and I said, hey, Bobby, where did you get that information? Hey, I didn't even know about that. And by the way, Joe Pomponio says that more than likely what you're talking about is legal news legalnewsline.com. I think that's what he says is a website. But anyhow,
yeah, I read all of them.
Yeah, when you come up with these things, I know that you put some postings on Facebook and so forth, but I think for us to get maximal coverage on things like this so that we can start making people aware, do a little bit more broadcast, and sometimes if it's something that falls into my purview, please go ahead and tag me on it so that I can add it to my stuff as well, because I wish I had known that, because there's an interesting blog post I'd like to write on that covering things on secrecy, and I want to bring in Dr. Theis here because he knows quite a bit about that as well. Doctor, I saw you.
Sure.
You cycled. Come on in.
Yeah. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Well, first of all, I wanted to say to Robert and George, or John, great job. I hate talking about the election this early also. There's way too much we don't know, and there's way too much that's going to happen for anything to have much meaning. But having said that, I did want to comment on what Joe was saying, and then also on what Robert said. I mean, first of all, Robert, it's not surprising that something that happened in the Intelligence Committee would be classified. Most of what they do, they classify. But that's pretty much indicative of what's happened with all our government. We now have the most extensive surveillance state in probably the world's history, paying attention to everything we write, everybody we call, et cetera. And it's a government.
I'll even add to that on your point real quick, in that I just read this morning that the executive has classified more documents, 30% more documents than last year alone, and more than the history that has ever been done. I just wanted to mention that.
That doesn't surprise me at all. This president has been worse in that area than anybody previously, and I thought the last one was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
For people like Joe, I understand the distrust of government. But I would say, first of all, if you really want to rein government in, focus on the things that the vast majority of Americans can agree on, which is we don't want government listening to our phone conversations, watching our emails. And anytime I talk to people on the right, I never hear them complain about that. They're always worried about what government does to interfere with commerce. But there's a reason government does those things. There's a reason we have an 8-hour workday. There's a reason why we have government controlling what working situations look like. There's a reason why we have government inspecting meat, which interferes with the ability of meat producers to make their profits. The reason is because those corporations that were doing those things at the turn of the century were abusing their power. Their power over the workers, their power over the consumers. And that's a huge, huge problem that the right refuses to deal with. I mean, these regulations didn't just come out of nowhere because government wants to control people. They came out because people had real demands about the crappy food they were eating, about being worked 14 hours a day. And, the Republicans are still fighting to prevent the Mariana Islands from having a minimum wage. In Missouri, they passed a law, the Republicans passed a law, I think it was 2 years ago, relaxing child labor laws. So I think you got to be really careful when you focus on that.
Well, you're right. The 1890s was a horrid time, actually, that you mentioned that. It actually was part of the civil rights movement, too, because there was a lot of things going on in the corporate world down in the red states in the South, tied to the freedom of slaves and et cetera, and how people were working and what their grievances and procedures were, and what the matter of fact, there's a wonderful Supreme Court decision that came out in the 90s. I have to think about it. But there was a lot of, corporate evil going on all through the South, both against people and society. So that's a very good point, because it did turn, at the turn of the century, regulations did step up and had a lot to do with that.
And it had a lot to do with making our lives better as ordinary people.
And I think that is where we really have to start getting the narrative changed, because I think until people... it's a lot of our representatives' faults that people have this distrust, but we have to work on not losing the beneficial parts of government, which I think with the absolute statements that a lot on the right have with respect to simply government is no good, get government out of here, I think that is completely counterproductive. And I had John off the mic for a while, so let me see if John has something, Mr. San Antonio, to add to the discussion. John?
I agree with Roberto to a certain extent. Another thing that they're talking about is this bill that 34 Republicans are co-sponsoring called the Enumerated Powers Act of 2013, which would basically they'd have to cite a congressional authority before Congress has to act in that area. But they would basically what it would do once, if this would ever pass, of course it won't pass, but I mean it just shows how crazy this is in 3/4 of the Senate are signed on to this. it would make it impossible, you know, for the federal government to protect workers' rights. And so this is what Ian Milhauser of Think Progress wrote about. It says to translate this language a bit, in the late 19th century, the Supreme Court embraced an unusual narrative interpretation of the Constitution's provisional enabling Congress to regulate commerce among the several states. Under this narrow reading, which lasted for half a century, the justices said that they would only permit federal laws that regulated the transport of goods for sales or sale itself, manufacturing, mining, production, and agriculture, were all to be held to beyond federal regulation. This theory was a basis for several decisions striking down basic labor protection, including a 1918 decision declaring child labor law unconstitutional.
What was the name of that? You found that at Think Progress? What's the name of the what's the bill?
Yeah, it's called the Enumerated Powers Act of 1913. Okay. And Coburn and Paul's bill appears to be an attempt to restore the constitutional regime that prohibited child labor regulation and other such nationwide regulation of the American workplace. While the bill does not apply retroactively, so existing labor laws would continue to function, the bill does have a procedural objection to be raised against any new legislation that does not comply with the limits imposed by the bill. Such an objection could be used to block almost any attempt to enact new workplace laws, such as increasing the national minimum wage or a bill prohibiting all employers from firing workers because they are gay. Similarly, Coburn and Paul's bills could permanently entrench decision by the conservative Roberts Court rolling back existing protections for workers, such as a recent decision shielding many employers whose senior employees engage in sexual harassment. So,
John, that was a great get. I just found the article, and I'm about to put it onto my notes here because that is something that that needs exploring. Thank you for that one.
Yes, it does.
That is darn good catch, my brother.
Yeah, and I was watching this on. They were talking about it. I think it was on yesterday. It was a repeat that was on C-SPAN. There's a House bill also, which is slightly less expansive, but you know, it's really unbelievable that these things are even being considered. I mean, it's just like, you know, everything has to be essentially approved. You know, everything that affects workers has to be approved before it could go into effect. I just don't, you know, from a constitutional, they have to point to the Constitution and say, how is this constitutionally active? You know, it's crazy. So,
well, it boils down to corporate personhood as the reason that, I mean, if they're going to say that corporations are people and make corporations have constitutional protections, again, as I say all the time, there's our problem. If they wouldn't be able to use, they wouldn't have that out even to support. That's where that's all coming from. It's all coming from, obviously, by the money side of it. And I echo what Egberto said about the about the good catch. I actually saw that as well. I did not read through it as well. It's on my ridiculous list. But again, it goes right down the pipe. The same mindset where, for example, last week they had the nomination for the one of the circuit, the D.C. circuit judges. Finally, they're voting on it. So in committee, they vote on it, and every Republican's not going to vote for that, but they also believe that she's qualified. Qualified. But they're going to vote against it anyway. Congress is out of control.
Robert, you're fading out, Robert. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You're fading out a bit.
Sorry. Congress is just out of control. And that aspect of it, I mean, you know, as far as right, left, or whoever, there's no question that the conservative side of it is defending the corporate argument. But as you know, I don't give the left a pass on any of this. Because if I could, and I could come up with a list of 10 people that actually work for us, because then I would have at least one side, and I don't believe it exists. I believe that a lot of their acquiescence is their way of getting their little payoff from the corporate side, and in so many aspects of it, which is why I do like Warren. And that vote you were talking about, by the way, was the Monsanto
That's it.
Yeah, it was the Monsanto vote where they got the free ride from Congress. I was furious with her.
Right.
With that, you know, and again, you know, as John said, you know, the best, you know, of a long list, you know, you kind of compromise a little bit when something like that happens. I have an issue when our elected officials do not, when they, and this wasn't that case here, but I have a problem with our elected officials when they violate the Constitution or the rule of law, because I can't put them back. They pretty much get one chance for with me, and then I'll see you later. You know, so I'm a little harsh that way, but geez, they're supposed to be serving us in the first place, and they take the oath. It's like they don't know what they're doing, and they don't get the oath, I guess. I don't know.
Well, no, actually, the reality is I think a lot of them don't know what they're doing. I mean, think about it. If you were to run for anybody can run for these jobs. I mean, you have to really I think it's understandable that folks don't know the intricacies of the Constitution or whatever. I don't, you know. I mean, I depend on speaking to knowledgeable people when I run into something when I don't know it. So, I mean, I don't think we should judge the politicians necessarily for their how experts they are on the Constitution. What we judge them on is how experts they are.
I think we need to. I think you need to, and I'll tell you why. When they
don't misunderstand me, Robert. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm saying I don't hold them personally accountable for being geniuses, but I hold them personally accountable for not doing their homework.
Right. Well, I mean, they are. I mean, what gets me about the whole thing is that they are one of the three branches.
Right.
So when, you know, if maybe they don't know the full extent of what they're doing when they get in. Okay, I can give many passes. But we're talking about one of the three branches of the government. And it's the same thing with the executive. You know, the executive has been trying to expand the executive power since the beginning of time. And that's why our balance is so important, and that's what we're missing, because we have three branches of our government who are not holding each other accountable. They're just letting them run wild. We are in trouble. That's one of the reasons why we're in trouble. We all three branches are like, oh, that's okay. Oh, that's okay. Oh, that's okay. You know, instead of holding the branches accountable to what the framers thought. You know, I know that there are issues from people who say that, you know, our document is a little bit out of date and it was written by elitists, et cetera. But I always argue that I think the document's good enough if you don't have the corruption and the money. If you remove those factors and you just change the Constitution legally the way it's set, if people say that's too hard, I says, well, we have three new amendments in my lifetime, so how hard is it really?
Well, I don't know. In our climate, it's pretty hard. In the climate that we're in today.
Well, yeah, of course it is. It's gotten really bad.
Go ahead, Doc.
It's gotten insane.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the Constitution was written by elites. It was written by people that large number of them had slaves, et cetera. But they weren't idiots. They understood that the world is going to be a different place down the line. And they made arrangements for that. I mean, one thing I like to ask people who talk about limited government, express powers, is the Air Force, by that, if you want to talk about express powers, is unconstitutional because the Constitution is very clear and very specific about land and naval forces. And nowhere does it mention air forces, which, of course, it wouldn't.
Wow.
I mean, how are they
going
to mention air forces when they didn't know anybody could fly? So they put in provide for the common defense. In the same way, they put in provide for the general welfare because they knew situations would change. So those people that want to read the Constitution word for word exactly as it is have to explain to me how they support having an air force.
Well, sure. Absolutely. I mean, you're 100% right. But my point is that the beauty of the document is that it has three branches of government that is supposed to keep an eye on each other, especially when it comes to the area of individual rights, which is what the beauty is of the document, which is what it's supposed to be. And in fact, that they are no longer doing that because, of course, the Supreme Court is signing off on business, you know, all the time. You know, while we talk about these other famous cases. You know, the Chamber of Commerce is rocking and rolling right along. Everything is geared towards money, and we are no longer getting the balance. That's what's bothering me.
I think you're absolutely correct. And I think the reason they had the three branches, and you can go back to Federalist 10, Federalist 51, is they thought it would be difficult for one constituency or one group to control all three branches, and that the three branches, by their different modes of selection and different methods of operation, would be responsible to different constituencies.
Right.
What has happened, though, what has happened is corporate money and the power of the elites has gotten control of all three branches.
Right. That's how I see it, too. That's exactly how I see it, too.
And there's really no access point for ordinary citizens anymore. The one access point as it was created in the Constitution was Congress. Well, we go out and as citizens blindly vote for incumbents over 90% of the time, year in and year out. So incumbents
and we also
do whatever they want.
And we also vote by party blindly instead of the individual, unfortunately.
But for Congress, we actually, interestingly, vote less for party and more for incumbency. Because what ends up happening in congressional races, the districts are gerrymandered for one party or the other, and so the parties know it, and they don't spend the resources on their candidates in very many districts where there's an incumbent. And elites know they're going to spend their money. They want a return for their investment. So they're not going to put money on a guy that's running against an incumbent, a Democrat that's running against an incumbent Republican, in a district that's 60% Republican, because the incumbent's going to win, or vice versa.
That's a good
so
point.
The vast majority of them are not even close.
No, that's a good point. And you know what's interesting? It's kind of upsetting that apple cart, and we're getting a kind of unbalanced. Well, unbalanced is the wrong word. We're getting some interesting people put in there because of the polarized primary process. Is we have, you know, like the Tea Party is a great example where they're coming in and challenging incumbents and winning, and thus, you know, creating an ideology, because they have money behind them now, too, in the fractured party. You know, for example, Lindsey Graham is getting challenged. That's a big challenge.
Right.
If they get him out in South Carolina, they'll still win South Carolina, which goes right up what you're saying. They're still using the incumbent ticket on a Republican base, you know, which you could say the same thing in Massachusetts. If somebody, you know, like the what was the guy's name? Scott Brown. Right. So that was, you know, that was not the rule. That was the exception, obviously. And here we are back to Democratic again. It'd be the same thing if they did it there. So, yeah, I think your point is valid. Absolutely.
Now, that is interesting. Now, what is the solution to that?
My solution is that we break up the two-party system as fast and as hard as we can, and we remove the Republican and the Democratic names and anybody else's party's names from the voting booth, and remove the word incumbent, and people pay more attention about who the people are and what they are, and of course we remove money. Everything starts with me, with corporate personhood and money, and anything after that should be done right along that. And of course we do not restrict voting, we expand it. So we get the 60 million, 70 million people who were eligible to vote that didn't vote last election, and really find out what's going on out there, because people aren't voting. And, of course, the people who are voting are being restricted, as we see all the time with North Carolina and Texas. And I'm actually, as much as I dislike Holder, I'm actually glad that the one thing he is doing, because he's supposed, I mean, in this administration, one of the things that's in their wheelhouse should be at least black civil rights and voting rights, because that should be in their wheelhouse, even though they should be doing it, period. So I'm glad that he's fighting back against the Supreme Court's voting rights ruling and going after North Carolina and Texas, because he should. Those laws are absurd. But I wish he would do that on everything. You know, I don't like drones, and of course the NSA and the Patriot Act. You know, they really kind of need to step in line. Everything should be across the board. But at least they're doing something in that regard. So, and voting is a major importance. You have to get the voting restrictions out of the way.
Now let me ask you. Let's put it this way, because you know one of the things that I always talk about, and I sometimes get into trouble, is doing what is possible. And my question is, the show was what do we do, or what do we want out of government? That was number one. But number to when we're talking about what exactly can we do to ensure that government is actually responsive to what we want out of the government. You're saying, oh, we need to break up the parties. Oh, we need to remove money from politics. What is step one? In other words, we have marching orders from all our people that we are going to send out there to go ahead and do something to start reclaiming our democracy. What's the first thing that we need to do?
And let me ask, we need to write.
Let me ask Dr. Thijs first, then to you,
Roberto. Go ahead.
Well, the first thing we need to do is begin organizing at the local level in communities to pressure our legislators to pass the laws that are friendly to workers and to ordinary citizens. Until we organize in communities, it's not going to happen. But if we organized in communities, we could then push for campaign finance reform. I'd like to see two parties gone, too. The problem is our election system favors two-party competition, the winner-take-all single-member districts. Another way to do it, I'd like to get money out of campaigns. I'd like to ban private contributions to campaigns and instead go to government funding of campaigns. But then you get the whole issue of how's the government going to decide who to give the money to? Far better way is citizen funding of campaigns. And we could give, Bruce Abramoff, political scientist, talked about, or Bramowitz talked about this. We could create Patriot Bucks, where each registered voter gets $100 to contribute to the campaigns of his or her choice. That would make sure that our elected representatives were trying to raise their money from citizens, not from corporations.
I love that. Yeah. Who wrote about that?
Bruce Bramowitz is a political scientist. And I can send you the site.
Yeah, please do.
But he called them Patriot Bucks.
That is, that is one.
All private contributions except for, and every single registered voter gets $100 to distribute. It would really, really organize voters. It would also give voters a certain self-interest in seeing a candidate win and get them to the polls.
How long has this, that's been out, that particular...
It's been floating around for about the last 8 years or so,
five years.
Like that. I mean, there's various versions of that out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one slipped me somehow, but that sounds great. Patriot Bucks, everybody. And because not only that, it democratized who actually will be running in an election, right?
Right.
That
if I
want
to give my money to the Green Party, I can do it.
Right.
And if I don't care if they're going to get 1% of the vote or 50% of the vote, I mean, it would really fundamentally alter the way in which.
Right. That sounds like it should have a whole lot of appeal. I mean, and not only appeal, it should have an appeal on both sides of the spectrum. It shouldn't have appeal on the corporatocracy, but on both sides of the spectrum, it should have appeal. Now, the corporations are the ones that would fear it.
But remember, who shapes our debate, who determines what issues get talked about. And that's where the corporate media and our corporatocracy have a lot of power. They shape the agenda. They shape what's considered a legitimate proposal.
Right. But, Robert, don't you think a proposal like this is something that should be, that if promoted, could actually get traction? Because, look, I read a lot. I try to keep up with a whole lot of stuff. And anything can slip any one of us. But as soon as Dr. Thijs mentioned that, something that I probably should have known, I mean, it immediately took hold. Don't you think this is something that would take hold if we really promoted that?
Oh, I'm totally in favor of that. It happened for a long time, without question. And it's something that needs to have traction, and I guess I am guilty of not promoting it as much as I do the money and politics side. Of course, one of the things that I deal with on the money and politics side is that's in my face every day. Like on August 1st, for example, the state of Alabama's new law took into effect that says that corporations do not have a limit on the amount of money that they can give to any candidate on the planet in the state of Alabama. So
wow.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. There is no other word. Wow is the only word. And then we could go up from there. And it just took effect on August 1st. And, you know, oh, my God. Now I will say, as far as what to do to answer your question, you know, and that's a wonderful thing to support without, you know, and we should just keep giving traction to that. The state of Arkansas has on the amendment next year, and I've been talking about this because he was actually on, when I hosted for Dan a couple weeks ago, after I had Christina Tobin, Greg Deckelman was on. He's from Occupy Radio down in Arkansas. And he's part of the movement that put the amendment on the ballot for people to vote in 2014 that eliminates money from politics, period. Every direction you can think of, lobbying, donations, outside money, et cetera. And the way that they get around Citizens United is they only do it for local elections. So this way, and I'm actually trying to give it to you, but I can't because, of course, I can't go backwards on my stuff when I'm on the phone. But it is the Huffington Post did an article about it, about the law. Let's see, what date was that? On 7/11. It's called States Take Lead on Post of Citizens United, so people can read on it. But there's a lot more. Greg Deckelman, and you can look him up. Actually, he's friended to me. He's part of, like I said, Occupy, and he's also part of the United We Stand, a Free and Equal Election Foundation, which you know I'm a part of.
Right.
And so he got onto the show, and if you go to Press One for Democracy and you go back to the 3 weeks ago, what was that, the 15th? And you look at the archive shows, he's on for almost an hour talking about the way they did this law. So one of the things that I'm doing is I'm researching how to make the law, or how to start writing the law here in Georgia and getting the legislators involved here, if possible. Because we absolutely need this to happen, and if it happens at the state level, then the only place we wind up dealing with it is on the federal level. And,
right.
You know, we're all trying to do that already. Move to Amend, and by the way, I met with one of the Move to Amend people here in Georgia that's part of the national organization, Public School.
Who did you meet with?
You would ask me that.
Woman or man?
Man, just a second, I'll tell you.
David Cobb?
Hold on. I'm sorry?
David Cobb or Daniel Lee?
No, neither one of them. Hold on.
While you look, I want to ask John. John, earlier I asked both Dr. Tice and Robert Rodrigo about what they thought about that plan, the Patriot Bucks. Had you heard about it before, John?
Yeah, I've heard about versions of that. I mean, wasn't that actually in law in Arizona? I mean, not exactly to that extent, but there was a version of funding in Arizona that was passed in the 90s, which was essentially, taken down because of Citizens United. And the professor would probably know more about that law than I would, all the specifics. And it's probably not exactly the same, but it seems like it is similar. And there are all kinds of, similar situations to that in Europe. And besides the fact that they don't have, such a long process of running for president and running absolutely. But one thing I also would like to ask the professor is if he thinks that Citizens United will be overcome by a constitutional amendment, or does he think that if enough progressive presidents appoint progressive judges and on the Supreme Court, that it will be overturned by that Supreme Court? Because basically what the Roberts Court was threw out all these, 100 years of precedent and essentially, ruled against that. And so could I think that that's actually, through a political process, has more of a chance of being overturned than having, the three-quarters of the vote in 37 states and then, winning, three-quarters of the vote in the House and the Senate. So I'd kind of like to hear his opinion about that.
Dr. Tice?
Well, Yeah, it's 2/3 of the House and Senate and 3/4 of state legislatures. It's not an easy process, obviously. I would prefer to see it done through constitutional amendment. I was just having a discussion with a colleague of mine who said that's not really what constitutional amendments are for. But in fact, that's exactly what they are for. That they are,
yes, they are.
To shape what the meaning of the Constitution is. I don't have a lot of confidence in the court. I think a series of progressive presidents could change the balance of the court. And they could then reinterpret it. But remember, the original speech is money, money is speech decision, Buckley versus Vallejo, came in the aftermath of Watergate as Congress passed the Federal Election Campaign Act. And that was a pretty progressive court.
Yes, it was.
That made that decision that said, in fact, you cannot control people's expenditure of money for political speech. So I'm not sure a progressive court would rule that much differently. So that's why I would prefer a constitutional amendment.
It was a 5-4 decision, and if you look at public opinion, I know the judges aren't supposed to look at public opinion, but it's overwhelming. You know, it really is, and even in heavily Republican states, if you look at it polling by individual states, it really is incredibly disliked. And so,
right.
I do think that there is more. I mean, it seems like a really, really long-term goal to have 37 state legislatures overturn this. I mean, it's just, 13 states. I mean, think of the 14th most conservative state, and are they going to do that? I mean, look how many conservative states they are. I did a bunch of calling. In a progressive group, just to try to get my local congresspeople, the state senators, and local from the Texas House to see what their opinion was on it. And, you know, I got a few people to join in. But, I mean, you know, realistically, you know, Texas only has a third of the members are Democrats, and no Republicans are even going to consider that at all. And
I actually
chime
in on that real quick. John, I'll tell you this, a couple of things. One is corporate personhood was established, I think, in 1809, if I'm not mistaken, which was the beginning of all this problem with giving...
You have Pacific Rail versus something, right?
Right, exactly. And to give your point about Democrats, for example, I don't know when it was, maybe 6 months ago or so, it might have been a little longer. No, it probably was a little longer ago, when Elliot Spitzer still had his show. Of course, he's a Democrat. The Democrats are not an ally on this as much as you think. Elliot Spitzer, for example, has come out and clearly said that I do not want Citizens United overturned because I am concerned about free speech. There's the rub. Because corporations are now considered people, they have to have the speech rights. And I always say it that way because a lot of times, to me, this argument misses the connection between those two points. And so it's not so much that Citizens United is wrong to me. It is the fact that corporations are people, which is the wrong one to me.
Robert, you hit it on the money, and that is why I moved to amend. Don't only have that free speech is not money, but it also includes that corporations, artificial entities, do not qualify for inalienable rights. It does, do not qualify for the Bill of Rights. Now, I think that is a very important concept that people have to get there. How great were things pre-Citizens United? They weren't all that good anyway before Citizens United.
Exactly. And see, and to me, it is so important to that aspect of Senate. And here's another reason why. When the Fairness Doctrine was removed, and you've heard me talk about this before, Egberto, the reason that the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, that's the wrong word, it wasn't a law, it was a policy per se, but the reason that Reagan
removed
the Fairness Doctrine was, is that his argument was
that it violated free speech to hold the media to the standard that the Fairness Doctrine did. Okay? So the argument is sound if you're going to accept that corporate personhood exists, which is why there's the problem, and that's why that disconnect happens like that. And, gentlemen, I'll be back in a few minutes. I got to deal with something relative to work. I'm going to put myself on mute so I'm not interrupting, and I'll be listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. Dr. Tice, you want to expand on that?
I would just say Democrats are not an ally on this either in general. Some are, but few of them. I mean, remember, we had a system of public financing of presidential elections after the debacle of Watergate that lasted all the way up until 2008, when Barack Obama raised $760 million and opted out of the public financing. And he outraised John McCain by over two to one. In this election, everybody thought Republicans were going to totally slaughter Obama in the fundraising, and it was virtually equal. So I don't think Democrats are hurt by this.
You know, it's sad that I was completely wrong about that, Dr. Theis. I really thought that the floodgates were going to be opened after, and actually they were open, but it was nowhere what we believed I'll speak for myself. Nowhere what I believed the outcome was going to be, which kind of is a bit demoralizing because it makes a lot of things that I've heard you along with our good old Evan Carroll mentioned about a lot of Democrats per se really come to pass. And now that we're seeing that this guy may potentially become the new Federal Reserve chair,
Larry Summers.
You really get to understand that the plutocracy really controls the whole darn thing, lock, stock, barrel, and it is something that we really have to be working at continuously. Because if Summers get in there, aren't these the guys that created the system in the first place? So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I'm completely convinced now that it is not... When it comes to these particular issues, it's not a Democratic or Republican thing. Now, we know for the purpose of certain humane programs, we have to make the exception, but they're all, for all practical purposes, in the same boat, Doc.
Well, and Egberto, you know what Trent Lott went on to do after he left the Senate?
Yes, he was a lobbyist, right, for the drug company?
Who's his partner in his lobbying firm?
A Democrat from Louisiana, right?
By the name of John Breaux.
John Breaux,
that's what I think Americans don't understand. For elites, this is about return on investment. This is not about partisanship. They could care less if Republicans or Democrats are in charge as long as they're getting policies they want. Americans get, citizens, ordinary people, get all wrapped up in whether it's a Republican and Democrat, fail to pay attention to the policies that emerge. And the policies that emerge are in many ways very similar.
Right. You know, that is what I was speaking.
Because the same people are funding them.
You know, I was speaking to the young man yesterday, right, because given that I am a lefty and he was more to the right, you know, the argument had become a left-right discussion, not an argument, because we had a very good discussion. It was a left-right, and not until we left those boundaries and said, hey, let's not make this about that type of a conversation. This conversation is what's best to move people forward, what's best for people, period. And then suddenly, you don't really have to sit down. And I think Robert is still on hold, but I mean that is the kind of stuff that we have to get to. Yes, we want to make sure and elect people that in the short term is going to make things okay for us. But man, we need to have some major changes to our body politic altogether. Doc.
Well, I think it's going to take a civic renewal.
Well, that you know, I hate to put it this way, but that's your job, senor.
Oh, so it's all on me, Egberto?
Well, I mean,
do what I can.
John, let me ask my friend in San Antonio, should we hold these professors accountable for making sure they send the right kind of folks out of their classes, man?
Well, I mean, I think that the professor's been on the mark on everything he says. So, I mean, I have got a lot of respect for the professor. But, you know, I agree with what you're saying. And I'm somebody who, you know, whose father was a union representative. And so I've been raised as a Democrat my entire life from my, you know, but I've drifted farther left, and I voted for the Green Parties in the 80s. And, and as time went on, I mean, I still feel a lot of regret, you know, when I'm not really given a choice. And I understand what you're saying. I mean, the whole plutocracy and the whole corporate takeover of America, I mean, money has always been a huge factor in America, but I mean, it's gotten incredibly worse since the trickle down era, and inequality has obviously gotten worse. And so, but I mean, a lot of times you just don't have a choice. In other words, let's look at the race for the Senate. I'm really into, I mean, I'm also into the bare bones of policy, but I also like to understand who is going to rule, who is going to have power. So if you look
right
at the Senate and all of the people right now, you have who is going to are the Democrats going to hold the Senate, and the people who are going to be running or like are going to be close are like the Begich race in Alaska, the Landrieu race in Minnesota, the Hagen race in North Carolina, the McConnell race, and possibly the race in Georgia with Nunn running against
with
whatever Tea Party or
actually,
win.
It was Landrieu from
and
Louisiana.
So, Right. That's what it. But I mean, and so you know, very few of those are progressive people. But this is the reality of where we're at right now. I mean, this is reality. I mean, none of those people are like great, progressives who are going to move the country forward. But you know, like in my city council, I had a choice between a big money Republican or a Tea Party person. And, you know, I didn't know who to vote for. You know, I put a lot of thought to her. And finally, I voted for the Republican because at least they don't want to tear down everything. But, I mean, you know, you should be given more choices. And I agree, there should be more parties. But at the same time, let's say there was a progressive party that formed, and they were, wouldn't they just dilute the vote and ensure that Republicans win? And you also have
the theory
about
that.
And I do think that there is more of a difference, and I'm not saying that there is incredible corruption. And I was talking about with Hillary Clinton before, and but there is still a slight difference with the Democrats, and they should have to answer to their base. And so
right.
So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
No,
I
agree with you, John. I agree that there is, and I don't think the difference is slight at all. I think there is a big difference. It's only the corporatocracy part that's all the same. But when it comes to the willingness to support issues to keep the working man more viable, I don't think it is even close. But I see your point. But Dr. Tice has a theory about whether you're wasting your vote or not. So why don't you tell him what we talk about in that regard, Doc?
Well, I don't think voting for third parties are wasting your vote, because I think third parties are what keep the two major parties honest and which move the terms of the debate. I mean, if you think back, there was a lot of radical organizing going on in the 1930s, 1920s. When we had, and they allowed, that gave room for progressives to move the agenda to the left. By the 1950s, there weren't even 1950s and into the 1960s, there were very few Republicans that would call themselves conservative. I mean, Nixon created the minimum wage. Nixon created affirmative action, of all things. So Nixon was probably, when you look at it, as a Republican, more liberal than Obama is today. So voting for a third party, if they get enough of the vote, 5, 6, 8, 10% of the vote, they'll have to win. One or both of those major parties are going to adopt their ideas. It's exactly what happened with the progressives under Roosevelt when he finished second. The Democrats simply adopted his ideas, Wilson did, and we ended up having two progressive parties. So I think it's always good to vote your conscience rather than to fall into that lesser of two evils trap.
Now, there's only a few... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, here's my answer to that. If 2016, we were talking about this earlier, if there is whoever wins, and I think that Chris Christie would be just as would have slash and burn tendencies to the social safety net, and would vilify unions like he's already done, and would be totally, you know, awful economically to our country. And if they control the House and if they control the Senate, they will eliminate this filibuster immediately, because a party that really believes in the debt ceiling using the debt ceiling like they are as a hostage weapon, they're not gonna worry about Senate rules. And so at that point in 2016, people are gonna be in an incredible shock. I mean, they don't understand how severe the Republican Party is. They really don't. I mean, just like what I read before about the Enumeration Act, I mean, these things will be passing all the time. I mean, there will not be a social safety net at all. And
that's why one of the things that I say is, you know, I agree with the votes in certain instances, but I think there are certain critical points where critical points where I think that has to be mitigated. As an example, my contention in 2012 per se was we needed the presidency up and until 2016 to ensure that a lot of, in as much as people have problems with the Affordable Care Act, that at least some of those things were codified so that people started using it, because after they've started using it, taking it away comes with a price. No comments.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like, you know, people don't really want to face. I know you do. I know you do, Egberto. And I know it seems like the professor, when he was speaking earlier, he was talking about that. But, I mean, let's talk about, you know, what's been the talk about what's been going on this week about, you know, Cruz and them threatening, to defund Obamacare. And I know it's not going to happen, but everybody seems to be caught up on actually the government shutting down, when the real problem is going to be the debt ceiling. Because,
right.
I mean, the government shut down for 28 days in 95 and 96. And, you know, I feel sorry for the people who worked in the parks and people who couldn't get passports and the other people who were affected. But, I mean, most things went on as usual. I mean, people
right.
got their Social Security checks, the military was able to operate, and people got their Medicare checks. And so maybe the professor can talk a little bit about what would happen. I mean, how would they get their funding if it goes on for more than 28 days? Because I know that there is a certain branch who determines, I mean, essentially it's the executive branch, but there is a branch that determines what spending is mandatory and what spending is not mandatory.
Doc?
So.
Well, I don't really think that completely defunding the government is ever going to be an issue. Down here in Texas, you notice the last time the government was going to close, Texas was up in arms that the government in the airport in Conroe and the airport in College Station was going to close. And the state legislature and the governor said, we're going to come up with the money to keep those airports open. Okay? So there's just, I don't think it's a real issue that they're ever going to cut funding. That's used as a ruse to cut the programs that matter to working Americans. So they'll gut the Food and Drug Administration. Well, that's bad for us as ordinary people. It's not so bad for the pharmaceutical industry or for the factory farms. And they'll do things like that. They're not going to cut defense, which is probably the biggest waste hog around. And when push comes to shove, even Republicans know they're not going to do these things. It makes for great rhetoric, but it's nothing that's going to be followed through.
But shouldn't the mainstream media, I mean, be you know, calling out people who are even threatening a debt ceiling shutdown and saying we're going to let the U.S. government default because we hold one branch, the House, and we want our way. You know, we don't hold the Senate, we don't own the presidency, but we have one branch, and we're going to blow this whole thing up. I mean, I agree with you. It's probably not going to happen. But, you know, look what happened with sequestration. Obama didn't hold tight. He didn't say I'm not going to negotiate with you at all. You're going to go ahead and fund the government, and if you don't, you know, it's going to be your fault. And so I hope he sticks to it again, and I hope what you're saying is true. I hope it is rhetoric. But that rhetoric shouldn't even be talking about it. It should be, you know, really put down, and it isn't doing that. People all the time, Bob Woodward wrote a book about the debt ceiling, and he thought it was perfectly fine what Boehner did. You know, he thought, right. You know, he was talking about Merlot and drinking Merlot and the president chewing the Nicorette, and that was, you know, that's what he wanted to talk about. He said, this is what Boehner is doing. This is legitimate. It seems like, you know, people use this false debt argument, and they're still going to use it to make these terrible concessions. And Obama made a terrible choice by negotiating with them, and I really hope he doesn't do the same thing again. He's already starting to. I mean, there's already been negotiations between his chief and staff and a lot of Republican senators. I mean, this has been talked about in a few articles.
Yeah, what's mad about that, supposedly?
And, I mean, they're mostly talking about a CR, and like I said, the CR I'm not as worried about, and even if the government shuts down, I'm not as worried about that. But one thing I am worried about is a lot of the Tea Party people are saying, they're going to say, look, nothing's going wrong, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, people are still getting their checks, everything's still going on, we can just continue to do that. But it at a certain point, I mean, this is what I remember from the last shutdown of the government, is that at a certain point, you know, money has to come in. They have to make a decision.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, it may not be after 20 days, but, I mean, it may be 60 days or it may be 90 days. And then they'll start making more drastic cuts. And so
John, I gotta stop it here because we're about the close of the show right now. So what I'm going to ask is you to give me a closing, and then Dr. Tice a closing, and then we're going to wrap this up. I enjoyed what we had to talk about so far today. So go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just want to thank Dr. Tice. I thought he was great. I thought he was one of the best guests you've ever had on, and I really admire him. And I know I disagreed on a couple of points, but I guess about 98% I agree with. And as far as the question of what do you want from government, you know, I would like a lot from government, and I think it should be supplemented by our tax dollars, too. I mean, I really believe in the Scandinavian model of, you know, of having health care, of having free education, not just K through 12, but on to get your college degree, and or even further if you want to get a PhD or whatever, you know, that should be paid for too. And so I believe that that the government can do a lot that can do and to help people. And I'd also like to say that that there's a last week I talked a little bit about the exchanges and in ACA, and I did make a mistake. There's actually a healthcare, the Kaiser healthcare calculator, where you can go in and you can put in your numbers and you can see exactly how much of a subsidy you're going to get. And I would really advise everybody to look this up. It's called the Kaiser healthcare calculator. And for those states. Those states that have Medicaid, I hope people sign up for the Medicaid program, and I just hope to see people helped. And like you said before, I'd like to see Obama talk about the working class, not just about the middle class. I mean, I want to see the middle class get bigger, but the working class should be addressed too, and he shouldn't be afraid to talk about the working class.
Thank you very much, John. That is great. I'll see you next week. Dr. Theis.
Well, let me say, first of all, to John, yeah, I think the media should be calling people out when they hold to these kinds of positions. But you ought to do a whole show on the media, because the mainstream media doesn't do a very good job of covering politics at all. You know, they're for-profit. They show commercials. And they want to go with the easiest story, and the easiest story is shoving a microphone in front of an elected official. So what we get is that official and then the official on the other side of the aisle. And it's a really horrible way to talk about public issues. Places like this show, the internet, talk, different blogs are much more open forums to discuss politics, and they're much less wedded to that profit motive. In the end, democracy is about figuring out what do we want for government? What kind of society do we want to live in? I think it's really important to have these discussions because, you know what, I have certain ideas of things I want, but I'll almost guarantee you I'm not completely right about any of it. And if I think about the last 30 years of my life since I became a political age and started thinking about many of these issues, my ideas on issue after issue after issue has evolved and changed over time. I think if anybody thinks the same way they do today as they did 10 years ago, then they haven't been looking at any evidence. They haven't been thinking about their issues, because we live in a different world, and different world requires different things. So I'd like to encourage you to continue having discussions about what government should do.
Thank you very much, Dr. Theis, and thank you for giving us a great show here on our Body Politics. This is Politics Done Right. I want to remind folks that we have several shows. On Mondays at 10 p.m., we have Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, we have The Middle Ground with Michael Chorney and Eric Beiler. On Thursdays, you have Lunch with Loudon. And that is at 3 p.m. Eastern. That's on Thursdays. And, of course, on Saturdays, you have me here at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 Central, Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. Thank you very much for being spending these 2 hours with me or whatever time you spent with me. Please remember to go to www.coffeepartyusa.com, www.coffeepartyusa.com, and join us. We're moving towards informing and keeping our body politic in a mode to move our working class or middle class, all Americans, forward. Have a wonderful weekend. Thank you very much for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bert.
Thank you, John.